highlighting the origins of classical music from the medieval era through the Renaissance and Baroque periods.
If you're free early Sunday mornings, we hope you will join us. Hosting a show on WORT includes choosing what to play, typing in your playlist, on-air announcing, and basic audio engineering.
You don't need radio experience, just a passion for this style of music and the willingness to work with us to increase and engage the many listeners and supporters in this show's early morning audience.
You can share your appreciation for this ageless art form by joining our 8 to 11 Sunday morning classical lineup. Volunteer applications are available at the station or online at WORTFM.org.
WORT is an equal opportunity, affirmative action organization, and members of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply.
Welcome to Radio Literature, Madison's weekly look at poetry, fiction, nonfiction, theater, and experimental writing for readers of all ages. Settle in for a half hour of conversation on radio literature. Here's your host, Melvin Hinton.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Radio Literature. My guest is Heather Rinkin. Besides being a wonderful actress, a wonderful reader, a wonderful theater consultant, because that's how that's more or less how I thought of her, mainly when I first met her.
Sure.
Because you were somebody, you were a consulting. You were the consultant for somebody who was directing a play.
Yeah.
And so she's all these things. And in addition to that, she has a name that I love, Heather. I love that name, Heather.
I'll tell my parents. They'll be thrilled.
Oh, good. Good. I like making people smile and making people happy. And a few weeks ago, we presented some excerpts from one of my favorite magazines, The Reader's Digest. And tonight we're going to read a few things from another of my favorite magazines. And of course, these are magazines that have been around for many, many decades, the Saturday Evening Post, which it's, I suppose, the subtitle of the Saturday Evening Post is Celebrating America, Past, Present, and Future. It is one of the oldest journals, magazines, periodicals published in the United States. And I'm going to ask Heather to start off giving us a reading from a section called From the Archive. And this edition of From the Archive, we're reading from the May-June 2020 issue. This edition of From the Archive is called Best Column We've Ever Published. And here's Heather Rinkin.
The love of beauty, wrote Emerson, is mainly the love of measure or proportion. The person who screams or uses the superlative degree or converses with heat puts whole drawing rooms to flight. The thing which impresses me most in my own country is the constant use of the superlative degree, said a woman recently, returning from a long sojourn abroad. I did not notice it in Great Britain, nor on the continent. But here I hear about the highest building, the best-selling novel, the paper with the largest circulation, the most eloquent preacher, the youngest college graduate, the oldest inhabitant, the fastest horse, and the most palatial yacht, till I feel like asking if there are no degrees but the superlative. The steamship which brought me over had to break the record for speed. I have been staying for a few days in the town where I was born and bred, and there I found the superlative degree rampant. The people voted a Morris chair to the most popular Sunday school superintendent, a ring to the prettiest girl, and a dictionary to the most popular school teacher. Perhaps by this time they are giving a silver cup to the child who has eaten the most food. Recently, I met a young man who had been the speaker in the legislature of a western state. He was introduced to me as the youngest ex-speaker in the United States. I felt like asking, what I was expected to do about it. I had never seen any work on etiquette telling one how to acknowledge an introduction to the youngest ex-speaker in the United States. Within the last few months, we have seen portraits of the youngest college president in the country. A friend told me that she had been looking up the history of the kindergarten in this country, and she had discovered that at least 3 women had been the first to import it from Germany. Riding home on the train, I remarked to a friend, "If I could find a place where people are simply good or bad, young or old, rich or poor, I would gladly spend my days there." But just at that moment, my friend put her hands over her ears as a vendor came through the car shouting, "Blank's chocolates are the best! Take no others!" The American Superlative by Adelaide L. Rouse, December 1st, 1900.
I remember when I was a teaching assistant in France many decades ago, the textbook they used in the highest grade was... because in France, they've always made a distinction between the English language and the American language. Mm-hmm. So for the French people, I did not speak English. I spoke American. but anyway, I got along fine with the English teachers, so, and they liked me.
Oh, good.
In fact, one of them was always telling me how much comparing me to the English person they'd had the year before, and how he never knew any the answer to any question she asked him, and I knew all the answers.
Well, good for you.
But and I remember in this book that I mentioned, one of the many things they pointed out as differences between American and English is that the American language was much more exaggerated. Everything was extreme, just as you've read in this article here. Yeah. And one of the only example I can think of, they give a lot of examples, but the only one I can think of right now is how in Britain, people stand for office, whereas we run for office. So Heather, when you I assume you went to college.
I did. Yes.
And when you went to college as a freshman, did you go there to become an actress or a theater person?
I was there as a theater major.
Okay, yeah. From the beginning.
From the very beginning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I had done a lot of work in high school. I was very fortunate to have had really wonderful arts programs growing up. You know, they're so important for young people to have those outlets. And so, yeah, I started my love of theater started in school, and actually pretty early. The grade school that I went to in it was in St. Anne, Illinois. They had plays from the time I was doing plays from the time I was in kindergarten, first grade. There was a teacher named Miss Busick, who was a third grade teacher who did productions every year. And it spurned my love of theater, but also my love of reading. I think being able to read and interpret a text is so important when you're an actor, and also when you're a shy individual, like I was then and am now, being able to disappear into those worlds and also become someone else was quite a comfort at the time.
Most people, I think, find it hard to believe that artists, performing artists, can be shy, especially after they have had quite a bit of experience performing before big audiences.
Sure.
But I remember having lived in Spain for many years, I remember 2 Spanish performers, one the great Spanish soprano, Montserrat Caballé, and she said that she hated if she could see the face of one person in the audience. She said it just bothered her so much. Yeah. So she tried, you know, to always look in the distance, never look you know, near the front rows, because she was afraid she might see look somebody in the face, and it would bother her. And there was another singer whose name I don't remember. He was a pop folk singer, but very, very popular in Spain and in parts of Europe as well. And he said the same thing. He said, if I see one person's face, I cannot perform.
Oh,
that's what
goodness.
He said.
Wow.
So this is what he said. He always insisted. The theater must be completely dark. He did not want to see the faces of the people in the front row.
Right.
I think he said it was written into his contract.
Sure.
But, and I understand that very well. Because when you, all of a sudden you see, especially if it's somebody you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Because
right.
it just, it disturbs your concentration.
Right. Because all of a sudden you're worried about them seeing you, but then also the expression they have while they're looking at you.
Yes, yes.
What sort of judgment is being passed in that moment? And that can certainly be something that can stop you in your tracks.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So where did you go to college?
I went to Butler University in Indianapolis.
Did you say Butler?
Butler, yes. Uh-huh. In Indianapolis, mm-hmm. Indiana.
Mm-hmm. And then when you left college, did you immediately go into professional theater or?
No, I immediately went into marriage.
Oh.
And, I started a family and did community theater for quite a while until my children were a little bit older, and then started doing more semi-pro professional work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have any preferences for the kind of theater you like to do? I mean, you like comedy, you like musicals.
I love all of it, but what's really exciting is working on original work, is working on the doing a work for the first time, working with the playwrights, creating characters for the first time. I find that extremely exciting and exhilarating work.
Mm.
I found my love, and a lot of that was because of Broom Street Theater.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the first theaters I participated in when we moved here to Madison.
Yes.
And not knowing how much I loved it until I started working there, and now it's almost exclusively what I do is work with new
uh-huh.
work.
Mm-hmm.
So
tell us about where you are now as far as your theater work. Goes.
Yeah, I am very fortunate to be the artistic director at Encore Studio for the Performing Arts, which is a professional theater company for people with disabilities. It is the first professional theater company for people with disabilities in the state of Wisconsin. So we're very, very proud of that.
Mm.
And yes, and I still find the work very exciting and exhilarating. And it's always wonderful to create new things with
yes.
with everyone.
So I'm pretty sure that I know that you, besides acting, you also direct.
That's correct.
Yes. Is there any conflict between those two? Do you have a preference or?
You know, there are different seasons for everything, right? And sometimes I find that I want to do some more performing. That's been satisfied lately because I in the last 3 or 4 years have been participating in improv, which has kind of allowed me to be on stage and perform with Atlas Improv Company here in town. But it's a bit of a different skill set, right? Other than being an actor, I hope has helped me be an effective director because I've been where they've stood. But it's a different type of creativity. You're looking at the piece as a whole instead of just your part in it.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I've wondered about for a long time is casting.
Mm-hmm.
How is it hit and miss, or is it an exact science?
Well, gosh, it depends on the piece you're directing, right? If it is an established work, then the text is kind of what you need to honor. You need to honor the story that's written and making sure that your casting decisions support the story that you believe is being told. When you're doing original work, the wonderful thing is you can write to the actor. And so then it's more about finding actors and personalities and qualities that you want to sort of exalt in your work and be a part of. So it's depending on the kind of work that you're doing, casting can be varied in that way.
I remember in the 10th grade for the spring play, the in the middle of the rehearsal time, the director, who was the speech and drama teacher, fired the leading man. I mean, I was the leading man, that's the wrong idea. Well, the protagonist, I'll say.
Oh dear.
And recruited somebody else, and who was the person he recruited then was perfect for the role.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
But of course, I felt sorry, and I'm sure the others felt sorry for the person who, had put in all that work, and then all of a sudden he couldn't perform in the play.
Yeah.
So Encore, I like that name.
Yeah.
In front of a live audience, in front of a live studio audience.
Right. This is our new project that opens a week from tomorrow. And it is a piece we've written based on classic sitcoms from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We have recorded commercials, and we have audience cue cards to laugh, to applaud. So hopefully it will be a fun evening for everyone who comes, and just a chance to see people in these works that you might not have seen certainly in the day. So, obviously our actors are people with disabilities, and we are highlighting them in very typical sitcoms.
Did you say something about tomorrow?
A week from tomorrow.
Oh, a week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow, May 3rd.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the dates here, May 3rd through the 18th.
Yes, correct.
And where does this take place?
This takes place on at 1480 Martin Street in Madison. We have our own theater space. So
we're talking to Heather Rankin, who is the artistic director of Encore, in front of a live studio audience, which will be performed May 3rd through the 18th. And give us that address again.
Sure, 1480 Martin Street in Madison.
Okay.
At the Mary DuPont Wallers Theater, which is housed in our building.
Now, there's some small print here that I can't make out. Oh, Wisconsin's first professional theater company for people with disabilities.
That's right.
That's very important. Now, were you one of the founders of this company?
I was not. I was not. I believe Kelsey Shanehar, who is our executive director and the former artistic director, was one of the founders when this theater was still a project of REM. And then we were able to go out on our own with a very supportive board and became our own entity.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why don't we get back to the Saturday Evening Post.
Wonderful.
And read another column or excerpt from there. I think the next one on our list was about Audrey Hepburn. Is that right?
There was one before it, but we can do whatever you like.
Did we say that? That's the one. Okay.
Yes.
Because the Post, one of the many things I like about the Post is that they go back to previous years and pick up things. First of all, they pick up things that they think would be of interest still to audiences or readers of today. But they also go back and reprint things that they're not too proud of, things that they think, well, today we wouldn't say this. So let's see.
New York sets the styles for the country, and on the whole, sets them badly. Through New York, we have imported not only the alien ideals of the European peasant that menace our institutions, but also the alien ideals of the European aristocrat that are no less threatening. The instability and irresponsibility that are characteristic of this New York are rapidly becoming national traits. We are in a constant state of hysteria or collapse over something. We live on the latest sensations and exhaust ourselves with superficial emotions. New York did not make the national temperament, but she has had a lot to do with developing and shaping it. She has been imposing her standards on the country, and of recent years, they have not been good enough or American enough. Gotham and Gomorrah, editorial, February 28th, 1920.
Well, I guess there's nothing new under the sun.
Right.
Did you grow up with the Post and the Reader's Digest the way I did, or not?
You know, I would see them when I went to my grandparents' house in Dubuque, Iowa. They would be sitting on the coffee table. And so I would read them when I would go to their house.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's the same here. I mean, they were everywhere.
Right.
I don't think anybody in our family actually bought either one or subscribed to them. But when I got older, I guess when I was a teenager, I started buying the Reader's Digest now and then on the newsstand, because then there were newsstands and you could just pick up magazines, comic books, whatever you wanted here and there, just, you know, in most places. And I remember I just loved reading the Reader's Digest and the Saturday Evening Post. And I'm glad that Norman Rockwell, who was the the artist always associated with the Saturday Evening Post, has finally gotten his due.
Right.
Because he wasn't taken very seriously when I remember when I was growing up. He was just dismissed as, I guess, almost as a hack.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
And but now people are, there have been retrospectives and studies done of his work. Let's see, we have a short article here. I forget what it's what the heading is. There's Audrey Hepburn.
Yes, when Audrey met Marlon.
Oh, yes. And of course, they're referring to Marlon Brando and Audrey Hepburn. Did you grow up with these two iconic people?
I do remember Audrey Hepburn. I loved the film My Fair Lady and just thought she was amazing.
Yeah.
But that's what I remember her most from.
Yeah. Yeah, she just, she always seemed so ethereal. It was almost as if she were, I don't know, an angel or a fairy or something rather than a real human being.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't remember what, well, the one film that I do remember, I didn't, until that time, I wouldn't have associated her with that kind of movie, but Wait Until Dark. Did you ever see that one?
No.
Oh, yeah, she played a blind woman.
Oh, wow.
Who was alone in her apartment, and I think somebody breaks into her apartment, and she's blind, and and it's I don't remember any more details than that.
Right,
but it was terrifying. I mean, for the audience, it was terrifying. I mean, because we felt every movement that she made and every expression on her face. It was just even without remembering the details, after, I don't know, 50 years or longer, that sensation still comes back to me just thinking about it.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if she got an Oscar for that or not, but it was Wait Until Dark. So I hope that some of you will go to the library or wherever you get your DVDs, movie DVDs, and find that, Wait Until Dark, starring Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah.
And perhaps we have time for one more piece. What do you have next there?
After that,
yes.
I have Answering the Holocaust Deniers.
Okay. So why don't we try that one?
All right.
We may not be able to finish it. I don't know.
Okay. Answering the Holocaust Deniers. Since my return to the United States, I have been asked by many people if the concentration camps were as bad as the newspapers have been saying. I can answer in one word: worse. The war correspondents did a good job of factual reporting, but there is a limit to what can be said in words and pictures. You have to walk into one of those places and smell the unspeakable stench, not only of the dead, but of the living. You have to see the blank stare in the eyes of many of the inmates, the animal-like way they crowd around you, their pathetic thirst for a little attention from someone who has just come from the free world outside. You have to experience the sensation of choking nausea which assails you as you walk through the barracks, with their tier on tier of filthy, crowded bunks, and see the living skeletons dying of disease and starvation, too weak even to venture outside and enjoy their day of liberation. You must walk also through the revolting muck of the streets and see the famished prisoners making soup out of the refuse of the garbage dump. See them wolf down a chocolate bar or a K-ration biscuit which you happen to have in your pocket. Before you are allowed to go into one of these pest holes, you are given typhus shots and doused with DDT powder to keep off crawling death. Yet when you come out, you feel that you will never be clean again. You want to take a bath in chlorine. You know, as long as you live, you'll never quite be able to get the stink of the place out of your nostrils, nor forget the scenes of abject misery you have seen. Journey to a Shattered World by Ben Hibbs, June 9th, 1945.
And of course, Ben Hibbs, the author of this piece, was the editor of the Saturday Evening Post.
Ah.
And he and some of the other writers and editors from the Saturday Evening Post went to Dachau concentration camp.
Oh my, yeah.
at the behest of President General Eisenhower at that time, because so many people did not believe that the concentration camps existed, and but General Eisenhower knew that they did,
of course,
and he wanted to, these American editors and writers to go there and document this this whole thing. So this piece is reporting what he found there, what one of them found there.
Yeah.
Yes. We did have time for that one.
Okay.
And so I want to remind you that you're listening to Radio Literature. I'm Melvin Hinton, and our guest is Heather Rankin, who is the artistic director of Encore. In front of a live studio audience, and is that the title of the play, In Front of a Live Studio Audience?
That's correct. The play is called Encore, In Front of a Live Studio Audience.
Oh, okay.
Right.
And it premieres on May 3rd and runs through May 18th at the Encore Studio for the Performing Arts. Is that right?
Right, at the Mary DuPont Wallers Theater, which is at 1480 Martin Street in Madison.
Okay. And so you can go out and support this wonderful endeavor. And I was glad to hear you say that you have your own theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Because there are many companies who don't have a permanent place to perform.
And we're very fortunate.
Yes. So thank you, Heather Rankin.
Thank you, Melvin.
I hope you'll come back and join us again before too long.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. And good night, everybody. And please come and join us next week at the same time for Radio Literature.
You've been listening to Radio Literature, a weekly program on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We are listener-sponsored community radio. Join us again next Thursday at 7:30 for more features of local, national, and international interest.
I saw the ocean's dawn.